This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories: Iran urges the European side in the Vienna talks to consider its red lines and avoid using media hype to sway the negotiations. Mali's military government tells France it need not wait several months before pulling out its troops, saying they should leave immediately. And from using pepper sprays and making arrests to towing trucks, Canadian riot police resort to heavy-handed tactics in dealing with freedom convoy protests.
Yeah, the lady got fully trampled by the horse.
Hello and welcome. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. The top story this hour: Iran's foreign minister is calling on the European parties to the Vienna talks not to make any miscalculations during the final stage of the negotiations. Hossein Amir Abdullahian advises the Europeans not to damage the negotiations with media campaigns. He says the European sides should keep in mind Iran's red lines in the talks and help restore Tehran's legitimate rights. He made the comments at a meeting with German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference. Baerbock says all parties should make every effort to pass through the current phase and open a new chapter in their engagement. The talks, now in their eighth round, aim to revive the 2015 multilateral deal from which the U.S. withdrew 4 years ago. In order to discuss that story further, I'm now joined by Fouad Izadi, a professor of international studies at the University of Tehran, joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Professor Izadi, thank you so much for joining us. Iran says the quality of a possible final agreement is equally important as its timing. At this sensitive juncture in the talks, we've seen a sudden rise in media hype, quoting both directly and indirectly European officials about a deal being near or a deal being in sight. Iran has, of course, officially rejected these reports, but would like to get your opinion on this. What is the purpose behind this media propaganda, and whether it's going to help the talks in any way?
As we get closer to the end of negotiations and JCPOA, you're going to see these type of tactics. The idea behind this particular tactic is that if you say that we are reaching an agreement, that puts pressure on the other side to accept your proposals, because the general feeling is that an agreement is very near. And that's a way of getting concessions from the other side. So that's one aspect of this story. The second aspect is called the blame game, which is designed to put the responsibility for the failure of the negotiations on the other side, saying that it was the demands that Iran made that resulted in not reaching an agreement. That's what they call them. They talk about the blame game. That's another tactic that's going to be used. And you're going to hear more of these type of activities as talks near its end. And that's very much normal. One thing we know is that Western countries do not have any limitations on using this type of tactics. Ethics is not part of their operating procedure, and they engage in any type of black or gray or white propaganda to achieve foreign policy goals.
Right. We also understand that there are still major unresolved issues, and that the sides involved are continuing intensive talks to reach an understanding. Iran has said nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. So do you see these so-called deadlines, which of course Iran has dismissed, and the off-the-record remarks by certain parties involved in the talks as an effort to maybe pressure Iran into sort of compromise on its stances?
The aim is to pressure Iran, and what Iranian officials have said repeatedly, that if the other side actually does what they say, which is returning to JCPOA, then you could have an agreement tomorrow. The problem that we have currently is that they want to keep some of the sanctions that were imposed during the Trump administration. That is a violation of JCPOA. And they want to basically have Iran accept their word when it comes to implementing the agreement, if an agreement is reached. And as you know, and as you have reported, every week you have people in the U.S. Congress writing a letter to Biden, talking about the idea of destroying whatever agreement the Biden administration makes with Iran. And that is not just the Republicans. You have people like Robert Menendez, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in the U.S. Senate, that says the same thing, basically, every day, almost. So it's not just the issue of Republicans versus Democrats. It's the issue of the U.S. Congress not accepting, the majority of U.S. Congress not accepting what's going on in Vienna. And given the political chaos in Washington, it would be foolish for Iran to just accept Robert Malley's word, because we really don't know how much he's actually representing the United States. There are some doubts whether he's actually representing the Biden administration, because there are people within the Biden administration that also have problem with what's going on in Vienna. So instead of pointing and sort of resolving the issues that the United States has, they resort to this type of propaganda that we have been talking about.
Many thanks, Professor Fadi Zadi, for the input. I've been talking to Fadi Zadi, a professor of international studies, joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Moving on, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, has had other meetings on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference in Germany. He has discussed various issues, including the situation in Afghanistan, with UN Chief Antonio Guterres. Amir Abdollahian and Guterres called for the formation of an inclusive government in Afghanistan. The Iranian officials said the formation of such a government that enjoys the participation of all political groups is essential for resolving the problems of Afghanistan. Amir Abdollahian also stressed the need for continued humanitarian assistance in Afghanistan. The country is facing a dire humanitarian situation as several Western countries have stopped giving it financial assistance in the wake of a Taliban takeover last August. A recent U.S. decision to seize half of Afghan frozen funds is expected to make the situation worse. Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, says it has successfully flown a reconnaissance drone over Israel. Hezbollah says the mission lasted 40 minutes and the aircraft returned untouched, despite attempts by the Israeli side to down it. The Israeli military said its air defense system fired at the drone, but it went off the radar before being intercepted. Reports say Israeli warplanes later flew low over the Lebanese capital, where a loud sound was heard. Earlier, we got in touch with Mariam Saleh, our correspondent in Beirut. She gave us the context for Hezbollah's mission and what it means. Here's more.
This is a very significant incident. It's not the first time that Hezbollah was able to fly a drone over, of course, what they consider is occupied Palestine, but they are monitoring the Israelis. And of course, this is specifically is very significant because the Israelis almost had no clue what was happening. One of the most important things is that the Israelis are launching right now maneuvers. They were actually taking place coinciding at the same time as the drone flew over. Hezbollah seemed to be sending a message to the Israelis that we know and they have intelligence, what maneuvers are being held. Maneuvers are basically a drill to see how the Israelis can deal with a possible Hezbollah, as they call it, invasion of the Galilee. And so if Hezbollah decides to go and attack the Israelis within the territory of Palestinian, northern Palestine, that itself is considered a very big concern for the Israelis. And this is why they're conducting these drills. And therefore, Hezbollah decided to fly those drones. And it's still not accurate whether it's one or two, but they flew the drones over the maneuvers, and they were able to monitor them. They were able to get intelligence. They were probably able to take footage of what was happening, and then that returned. The drone returned safely to its destination, and this in itself is considered very significant. The Israelis had to use F-16 fighter jets in order to try to target those drones, and still they could not, and they lost track of them finally, and just guessed that probably they went back. And Hezbollah, of course, stressed that this was done, and this was the case, that Hezbollah was able to fly that drone. So what we have here is basically a tit-for-tat strategy for Hezbollah. It's no longer just waiting for the Israelis to come bringing their drones to the Lebanese airspace, and Hezbollah trying to defend or deter them. It's also Hezbollah actually flying those planes over Israeli targets and military targets and military drones.
Mali's ruling military junta renews its calls for the immediate withdrawal of French troops from the African country.
In the light of repeated breaches of defense agreements, the Malian government asks French authorities to withdraw without delay Barkhane and Takuba forces from the national territory under the supervision of the Malian authorities.
The spokesman has questioned France's plan to pull out its forces over several months. He has also described as unsatisfactory the results of the French-led military engagement in the Sahel state for nearly 9 years. French President Emmanuel Macron says Paris and its European and African allies would withdraw their troops from Mali in what he calls an orderly fashion. Macron rejects the criticism that France has failed in its former colony. Relations between the two countries have been strained since the 2020 coup in Mali. France deployed troops there in 2013 under the pretext of fighting terrorists, but the operations have failed to quell violence and led to public discontent. Canadian police have arrested more than 100 people in the capital, Ottawa, while trying to disperse demonstrators protesting COVID restrictions.
They have been charged with multiple various offenses, including mischief. Work is underway by the City of Ottawa to remediate and clean up the area that we have gained back today.
Officers have cleared demonstrators from one part of the city and hauled away vehicles blocking the Capitol's core. Police have charged protesters with, quote, assaultive behavior. Footage on social media shows that some demonstrators have been pepper sprayed and others trampled by police on horseback. Authorities say it may take days to fully remove the protesters and tractor-trailer trucks. Some protesters have been dragged from their vehicles. Others resisting the police advance have been thrown to the ground before being arrested. The crackdown comes after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau invoked emergency powers to stop the protests. Truck drivers began their protests against coronavirus vaccine mandates in Ottawa almost 3 weeks ago. The demonstrations then spread to other cities. Demonstrators have also blocked several U.S.-Canada border crossings, disrupting transportation and trade. The U.S. president ramps up his rhetoric against Russia amid mounting tensions in Eastern Europe. Joe Biden once again claims that a Russian invasion of Ukraine is imminent. Listen.
But the fact remains, Russian troops currently have Ukraine surrounded from Belarus along the Russian border and with Ukraine to the Black Sea in the south and all of its border. You know, look, we have reason to believe the Russian forces are planning to and intend to attack Ukraine in the coming week. In the coming days, we believe that they will target Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, a city of 2.8 million innocent people.
Biden said he is convinced that his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, has already made up his mind on invasion of Ukraine. The U.S. president warned that war will close the window for diplomacy with Moscow. Biden also said Western countries will not deploy troops in Ukraine, but will continue to bolster its defensive capabilities. Earlier, the White House said Washington and its allies are working on a sanctions package in case of a Russian invasion. This is why Italy says the bans should not target energy imports from Russia. The situation remains tense in eastern Ukraine amid renewed fighting between government troops and pro-Russian forces. Ukraine's military says pro-Russians have opened fire on more than 20 settlements and killed a soldier. The leader of the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic has ordered a full troop mobilization over fears of an offensive by the military. Denis Pushilin has urged reservists to show up at military enlistment offices. Things spun out of control a few days ago when both sides accused each other of violating a 2015 ceasefire. Russia has expressed concern over the renewed clashes, describing the situation as potentially very dangerous. Andrei Kurtunov, the Director General of Russia's International Affairs Council, warns that the situation in eastern Ukraine is very dangerous. He says clashes there could soon spiral out of control. Stick a listen.
The situation in Donbas might be more dangerous than the situation along the Russian-Ukrainian border because the latter is more or less under control. And I still don't believe that Russia is ready for a full-scale invasion because this invasion is not likely to benefit Russia, and it will be a very costly enterprise. I don't think that Russia is in a position to occupy Ukraine or to take the capital of the country. However, what we see in Donbas is a very clear case of an inadvertent escalation, something that you cannot control. There are loose cannons on both sides, on the Ukrainian side and on the side of breakaway republics. And the worst case scenario is that the Kremlin will be forced to recognize diplomatically the leadership of the two republics. They would call Russia to grant them military assistance, and such assistance will be granted, which would mean that sooner or later we will have a direct confrontation between Russia and Ukraine in the area of Donbas. That will be the end. That would be the end of the Minsk agreements, and definitely that would have very serious implications for the European security at large.
A month's worth of rain poured down on the southeastern city in just 3 hours on Tuesday, the heaviest rainfall in 9 decades. Local officials have declared 3 days of mourning. A similar tragedy happened in the same region back in 2011, killing 900 people. Experts say rain has become heavier due to the cyclical cooling of the Pacific Ocean triggered by climate change. Well, that's your world news for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
All those trillions of dollars consumed in wasteful wars have helped foster a creeping pessimism in Americans. A pessimism spawned by corporate elites increasingly consumed by greed, says William Astore, a writer, in an article published under the heading 60 years of war-making may yet result in the destruction of U.S. democracy. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. Speaking of George Orwell, America's 60-year war, a losing proposition for the many, proved a distinctly winning one for the few, and that wasn't an accident either. In his book Within a Book in 1984, Orwell wrote all too accurately of permanent war as a calculated way of consuming the products of modern capitalism without generating a higher standard of living for its workers. That, of course, is the definition of win-win situation for the owners. In his words, the essential act of war is destruction, not necessarily of human lives, but of the products of human labor. War is a way of shattering to pieces or pouring into the stratosphere or sinking in the depth of the sea materials which might otherwise be used to make the masses too comfortable and hence, in the long run, too intelligent. Even when weapons of war are not actually destroyed, their manufacture is still a convenient way of expending labor power without producing anything that can be consumed by the workers. War was a way of making huge sums of money for a few at the expense of the many, who would be left in a state where they simply couldn't fight back or take power, ever. Think of such war production and war making as a legalized form of theft, as Icke recognized in 1953 in his Cross of Iron speech against militarism. The production of weaponry he declared 8 years before he named the military-industrial complex in the U.S. constituted theft from those seeking a better education, affordable health care, safer roads, or indeed any of the fruits of a healthy democracy, attuned to the needs of its workers. And war was also a way to stimulate the economy without stimulating hopes and dreams, a way to create wealth for the few while destroying it for the many. Domestically, the Vietnam War crippled Lyndon Johnson's plans for the Great Society. The high cost of the failed war and of Pentagon budgets that continue to rise today regardless of results are now cited as arguments against Joe Biden's Build Back Better plan. President Franklin D. Roosevelt's new ideal, arguably, would have never been funded if today's vast military-industrial complex or even the one in Icke's day had existed in 1930s. As political theorist Crane Brinton noted in The Anatomy of Revolution, a healthy and growing middle class, equal parts optimistic and opportunistic, is likely to be open to progressive, even revolutionary ideas. But a stagnant, shrinking, or slipping middle class is likely to prove politically reactionary as pessimism replaces optimism and protectionism replaces opportunity. In this sense, the arrival of Donald Trump in the White House was anything but a mystery and the possibility of an autocratic future no less so. All those trillions of dollars consumed in the wasteful wars have helped foster a creeping pessimism in Americans. A sign of it is the near total absence of the very idea of peace as a shared possibility for the U.S. Most Americans simply take it for granted that war or threats of war having a defined immediate past will define the future as well. As a result, soaring military budgets are seen not as aberrations, nor even as burdensome, but as unavoidable, even desirable, a sign of national seriousness and global material superiority. It should be mind-blowing that despite the wealth being created and often destroyed by the United States and impressive gains in worker productivity, the standard of living for workers hasn't increased significantly since the early 1970s. One thing is certain, it hasn't happened by accident. For those who profit most from it, America's 60-year war has indeed been a resounding success, even if also a colossal failure when it comes to worker prosperity or democracy. This really shouldn't surprise us. As former President James Madison warned Americans so long ago, no nation can protect its freedoms amid constant warfare. Democracies don't die in darkness. They die in and from war. In case you hadn't noticed, evidence of the approaching death of American democracy is all around Americans. It's why so many of Americans are profoundly uneasy. They are, after all, living in a strange new world, worse than that of their parents and grandparents, one whose horizons continue to contract while hope contracts with them. And here's what worries most of all. America's very long war of destruction against relatively weak countries and peoples may be over, or at least reduced to the odd moment of hostilities. But America's leaders, no matter the party, now seem to favor a new Cold War against China and now Russia. Incredibly, the old Cold War produced a win that was so sweet yet so fleeting that it seems to require a massive do-over. Promoting war may have worked well for the military-industrial complex when the enemy was thousands of miles away with no capacity for hitting the homeland. If a war with China or Russia or both comes to pass, it won't be a long one. And count on one thing. America's leaders, corporate, military, and political won't be able to shrug off the losses by looking at positive balance sheets and profit margins at weapons factories.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The recent revelations about the Trojan Horse scandal, a hoax plan for so-called extremists to take over a number of British schools, highlight the issue of institutionalized Islamophobia in the UK, and how victims of the government-backed Islamophobic purge are calling for justice and a fresh, independent inquiry. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll look at the different aspects of this scandal, as well as the role and goals of the British government in promoting Islamophobia.
The Muslim Council of Britain has demanded an independent public inquiry be launched to get to the bottom of who was behind the hoax extremism plot letter which ruined the lives of so many Muslim teachers. The call comes amid rising pressure on Government Minister Michael Gove, who was named and shamed as a key component which turned the bogus plot into a nationwide Islamophobic witch hunt in Birmingham.
It all started when a letter detailing an alleged extremism plot to take over and radicalise Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham was circulated by the press. Mr Gove, who was in office at the time, was aware of the letter, was warned that it's a hoax, yet decided to disregard the advice and pushed ahead with it anyway, adding fuel to the fire. It's believed that it might be his own personal prejudices against Muslims that fuelled this decision, based on the fact that he's written material in the past that's been considered deeply Islamophobic.
Press TV spoke to several victims of the witch hunt earlier this week. They are hopeful for legal retribution.
The allegations against us were based on hearsay,
The statements that were given by anonymous witnesses weren't substantiated, they weren't corroborated. Yet on the back of these allegations, our careers and lives were ruined, and we were ostracized. I was ostracized, demonized, vilified, seen as the bad guy.
A public apology for his actions, followed by a change in policy, because the actions that followed what was perceived to be a sinister plot on part of Muslim teachers, governors, and I was included within that bracket, that all of that was a complete fabrication and a lie. And so there has to be a public apology, and B, a rescinding of the policies that subsequently followed.
Apart from the racist and Islamophobic aspects at play, the Trojan Horse scandal was used as a pretext to enforce controversial counter-extremism policies which have penalised Muslims ever since. Press TV contacted Mr. Gove's office for comment but received no reply. But with demands for answers growing, how long can the silence remain? Robert Carter, London.
Well, joining us on Spotlight, we have Secretary General of the European Muslim League, Ms. Yvonne Ridley, joining us from Jedburgh, and head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajarib, who's joining us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start with Yvonne Ridley in Jedburgh. Ms. Ridley, it's great to have you with us. It's been years since we last spoke. So demands for an independent inquiry into Britain's Trojan Horse scandal have grown after this podcast recently highlighted several unanswered questions from the entire saga. So after so many years, why are there still so many unanswered questions?
Well, because as we've already heard in that excellent report by Robert Carter, that the whole Trojan Horse affair was one big hoax. But it didn't stop the government and ministers like Michael Gove acting as though this was a very real threat. And as a result, decisions taken affected all of the state-funded education in England and Wales. And there was a McCarthy-style witch hunt. But instead of people looking for reds under the bed, they were seeing Muslim extremists where there were none. Like all injustices, the Trojan Horse affair cast a long shadow over Muslim communities. And the real losers were people like the one that we just heard, whose lives and careers were ruined by the Trojan Horse affair. But also the long-term losers have been Muslim children in those schools, not just in Birmingham. This is right across England. I spoke to somebody today who was a school governor in Bradford who was edged out because people were seeing extremists everywhere where there were actually none. This whole affair has damaged people's lives, damaged careers, damaged the education in England and Wales. It's been very destructive. It's cast a very long shadow, and the government must be held to account. Good that the Muslim Council of Britain is calling for justice, but also ordinary members of the public have taken it upon themselves to sign a petition and try and force the issue to be debated in the House of Commons.
Master Chajare, in 2017, the cases against the teachers collapsed, but their defense has never been heard to this day. Who should be responsible for this? Who should compensate, basically, the individuals that bore the brunt of this fabricated scenario, despite numerous government reports, parliamentary hearings, and an array of legal processes? Why has the truth been so hard to pin down?
Well, what was being accused was that the Muslim community or certain members of Muslim community are coordinating, organizing to take over the education and divert and brainwash the children. Not just Muslim children, but children. But the reality was that the only people who were getting together to converse and create a coordinated effort to do damage and do unlawful things was Mr. Gove and his colleagues. You know, he brought Peter Clark, which was the ex-head of the anti-terrorism of Metropolitan Police, with no expertise in trying to actually unleash whatever was happening or what was being accused within the schools. But his expertise was to always see a Muslim wrongdoers around the corner. And this is why he was brought in. I mean, it is very important to remind the viewers that what happened prior to this was these schools which were turned around. They were failing schools. They were turned around by this team of dedicated Muslims, not just for the Muslim children, but for everyone. So here was actually a solution to the problems of education in inner cities, which the Muslims rose up and start addressing. And actually, they were commanded for this. And then because of a fraud, someone took a position of writing a false letter, and everyone, Gove as a minister and indeed everybody else in authority, jumped on that bandwagon and demonized the whole of the Muslim community, disassociated Muslims for being involved in the future of the children, their children, and indeed other children. And that sort of process of helping the education within inner city, turning failing schools into actually a proper school, was totally lost to the Muslim children and indeed everybody else. And I would say that on top of the fact that we have to blame the institutionalized Islamophobia, which is definitely behind this, we also have to blame the Muslim community and Muslim community institutions, because they failed to rise up and help and support not just these teachers, but stop the demonization of whole of the Muslim community. Their failure at the time, it really is very worrying. You know, when you compare the currently Sikh council sort of on the immigration bill, turning around to all the members of parliament and saying that anyone who's voted for this racist bill will be welcome to go into any of the temples, the Muslim councils actually failed miserably to support and indeed stand up against this institutional Islamophobia.
Ms. Ridley, you were nodding there when we were listening to Mr. Chajare. How do you perceive the role of the government in this scandal? And more importantly, what was the end result of it?
Well, I agreed with most of what Masood said, but I wouldn't blame the Muslim community. The Muslims in Britain, ever since 9/11, have been put under the cosh. There's been paranoia displayed towards Muslims. Islamophobia has been fueled And this race hate has really been directed at the Muslim community. Muslims back in that period, about a decade after 9/11, they felt under fire and had lost a lot of the confidence that they used to have. So when there was this deluge of criticism directed towards the schools about these Muslim fundamentalists creeping into the education system and trying to push extremist views onto the children, they just believed it. And of course, it was one big lie pushed conveniently by Michael Gove, who was one of the most Islamophobic ministers in this government, a government which has a reputation these days for pushing out lies on an almost daily basis. But what is also important in this, while Michael Gove was pushing this, he also used this fake letter as an excuse to roll out some extreme counter-terrorism measures, such as the notorious, now discredited, Prevent strategy in schools, which turned every teacher, every teaching assistant, even parents into spies, which again undermined the confidence of the community.
Indeed.
You know, children were, any children that showed, say, support for Palestine were reported to the Prevent scheme. Millions of pounds was poured into this discredited scheme, while the education budgets were creaking along and you know, not able to perform. So there was a big domino effect in this, but I wouldn't blame the Muslim community as a whole.
Okay, Mr. Shajara, you can also respond to that. That's exactly where I was going next. As a result of the government responded by implementing the so-called anti-terrorism prevent strategy in schools, it also made it a requirement for all schools to promote fundamental British values. Is religious intolerance being promoted in Britain?
Well, unfortunately, you know, we know that this government, and indeed the rest of Europe, the governments, and we are seeing sort of similar thing happening in France, Germany, and elsewhere. There is institutional Islamophobia, and the demonization of Muslim has become the norm, and we are in this environment of hate against Muslims. And the problem is this, that, you know, there is amnesia within those who are head of the so-called leadership of the Muslim community. Every time any incident happens, there seems to be somebody comes and push a button of reset button, and we forget about everything that has happened in the past, and we're forgetting that we are living in this environment, and then we get letters from the Muslim Council of writing to MPs and thanking them. I don't know for what, for the fact that they're not addressing the ever-increasing Islamophobia. And we need to be extremely critical of this Islamophobic government, which is actually more Islamophobic than previous one, and there's no doubt about that. But at the same time, we need to actually be internally criticizing ourselves, because our institutions are not fit for purpose. They still want to rub shoulder, and they think that they get influence by having a cup of tea or rubbing shoulders with a minister or two. And I think, you know, Yvonne knows this very well. I remember, Yvonne, you raised that once in a meeting we were to one of the very senior police officers. You know this, I know this, and unless we tackle this, unless we actually stand up when the situation is as bad as it is now, we need to be fit for that purpose. And that means we need to stand up not just for protecting the Muslim community, which needs to be protected, but the whole community, because this environment of hate is so poisonous that actually affects everyone, Muslims and non-Muslims. See what happened in former Yugoslavia. See what has happened previously in other structures when these level of demonization have been unchecked.
Ms. Ridley, the effects of such such affairs, such sagas, they are all-encompassing. 8 years on, this Trojan horse affair remains perhaps the best known and most polarizing story about Britain's relationship with its Muslim citizens. What have the British public, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, learned from all of this?
Well, sadly, I would think that the majority of the British public outside of the Muslim community are not aware of this excellent Trojan Horse podcast, which has been produced by the New York Times. Why is it that this excellent piece of investigative journalism and great expose has come from America? Because it should have come from the British media, but unfortunately, the British media is also institutionally racist and Islamophobic, and you know, this is where we have a problem. And what I would like to see the Muslim community do, not necessarily through the leadership of the MCB or any of these other Muslim organisations, is start to stand up. As I've often said, if you get up off your knees and stand up, the so-called great don't seem that great from that position. And so the Muslim community needs to get its confidence back. Maybe we should take a lead from the black communities in Brixton and in Toxteth. They got a lot of justice back through riots. I'm not suggesting Muslims rise up and take to the streets. You know, we have other mechanisms and other ways of making our points known. But maybe we should take a zero tolerance lead from the black community and be vocal and be robust and demand our rights. You know, human rights are for everyone in Britain, not just a few. And so this is something that we need to get a confidence back in the Muslim community. That's what we need.
Mr. Shajare, is the British mainstream media Islamophobic? Does it promote Islamophobia?
Yes, of course it does. They're promoting Islamophobia in many ways. And the fact that this sort of a story doesn't break out, the fact that, you know, even when it breaks out, you know, nobody is calling for resignation of Gove, which if it was, if the same treatment was dished out to any other community, they would have been called for resignation. And shrinking spaces, sort of 10, 20 years ago, a Muslim community as a whole had a more voice, a very diverse voice in the British media. Now it doesn't. And now it's even sort of Zionists speaking on behalf of the Muslims and everybody else, racist. So I actually agree with what Yvonne is saying. We need to be more confident in ourselves. And the last conference, which was in January, on Islamophobia conference, which we held, we looked at how we could work with the establishment. Should we work with them? Yes, no, maybe. And we looked at the historical, and indeed we looked at the experience of the black community, and we looked at it from a theological basis and everything. We need to revive the right of standing up to the bullies, because the bullies are taking over, and the government and the media are part of that bullying.
All right, thanks a lot. That's all the time we have for tonight's program. Allow me to thank my guests for the show tonight, Secretary General of the European Muslim League, Ms. Yvonne Ridley joining us from Jedbro, also head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajere, speaking to us from the British capital, London. And also a special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome back to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question that people often ask, and it's a very interesting question. And the answer to this question is tied up to the virtues and the benefits of the benedictions and the salutations that we send upon the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his holy progeny. The question that we want to pose today is this: who will be the closest of people to the Holy Prophet on the Day of Resurrection and in the afterlife? All of us as Muslims and followers of the Islamic creed have a natural and innate love for the Holy Prophet as our leader, as our prophet, you know, as the messenger of God, as the final prophet. And this is true not only for all the Muslims in the beginning of Islam, but also, you know, Muslims who live today. One of the things that we as Muslims who did not live in the time of the Prophet yearn for and wish for is to, you know, be physically with the Prophet, in the presence of the Prophet, see the Prophet, you know, look at him. And these are things that, you know, Muslims who weren't blessed with being present in the time of the Prophet often wish for. So you know, we ask God Almighty to allow us to be in his presence in the hereafter, right? So people often ask, keeping this in mind, how can we be with the Prophet in the hereafter? How can we be close to him in the hereafter? The answer to this question is that in a very beautiful tradition, it has been narrated from the Holy Prophet himself, that he, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, said, "Awla an-nas bi yawm al-qiyamah aktharuhum alayya salatan fi dar ad-dunya." The closest of people to me, or the most deserving of people, the people who most deserve to be in my presence and with me on the day of resurrection, are the people who send their salutations and their benedictions upon me the most here in this world. Right? So the Prophet here is giving us a solution to this problem. This is one of the virtues of the salawat and the benedictions that we send upon the Prophet. The more that we send our benedictions upon him, the more we send our salutations upon him, and in this way honor him and show our love and respect to him, you know, the closer we will be to the Holy Prophet on the day of resurrection and in the hereafter. This is one of the beautiful benefits and otherworldly virtues of this benediction. Of course, there's many virtues and benefits of this salutation. We're going to try to examine them in some of the forthcoming sessions of the key. This is one of those benefits and virtues, that the more we send our salutations upon the Prophet and more we send our benedictions upon him, closer will we be to him and in his presence in the hereafter. And we can easily see the correlation between these two things. And the more we send our salutations upon him, the more we remember him, the more we will try to imbue within ourselves the virtues that he was the embodiment of, and therefore the higher will we be in the hereafter and closer to him. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at one of the virtues of the benedictions upon the Prophet. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Muslim Council of Britain has demanded an independent public inquiry be launched to get to the bottom of who was behind the hoax extremism plot letter which ruined the lives of so many Muslim teachers. The call comes amid rising pressure on Government Minister Michael Gove, who was named and shamed as a key component which turned the bogus plot into a nationwide Islamophobic witch hunt in Birmingham.
It all started when a letter detailing an alleged extremism plot to take over and radicalise Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham was circulated by the press. Mr Gove, who was in office at the time, was aware of the letter, was warned that it's a hoax, yet decided to disregard the advice and pushed ahead with it anyway, adding fuel to the fire. It's believed that it might be his own personal prejudices against Muslims that fueled this decision, based on the fact that he's written material in the past that's been